Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
You know, we're artists. We're not on the treadmill. She didn't want to be on the industry treadmill. She did it on her own timetable when she was inspired.
All right, sad news from the world of music again. Sinead O'Connor died at age 56, and we'll take a moment this episode to pay tribute to her here on Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us today, we have a third co-host, Craig Rosen. Hello, Craig.
Hello, guys. Yeah, sad news. I was really sort of taken aback when I heard the news. My wife and I were walking out of a yoga class at the gym, and I saw her on her photo on CNN, and I said, oh no. And yeah, you know, it took a few seconds, and then it said, you know, dead at 56. And you know, you just get that sinking feeling. It was just awful, you know. I mean, it's funny, you know, these artists. And you know, for me, I think it began with John Lennon. You know, maybe Elvis Presley when I was a kid. But when we lose these artists, you know, it almost feels like you're losing a friend, because if you're really into that artist, you really love their music. It really, you know, it's like a gut punch. You know, it's like with Kurt Cobain and Tom Petty, Prince, yeah, and Bowie. And some might think that, you know, Sinead O'Connor, you know, wasn't an artist of that caliber. I would argue that she was definitely not a one-hit wonder, definitely a lot more there. But I know we have some callers that called in and left some stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, but you're right, Craig, and that was one thing I think is important, is that, you know, music, I think, by its nature, because it's so personal and it lives in your head, you do get that sense of a real connection with the artist sometimes. You know, if it's somebody whose music really affects you, right? And then you do feel kind of like a passing is, you know, somebody you know, you feel like you know well. You know, I had that moment with Joe Strummer. You know, when Joe Strummer died, that set me back a couple of days. You know. You do have that real sense of mourning. So anyway, so yes, we do have a couple of callers, a couple of listeners who sent in voice memos, I should say, with their thoughts on Sinead O'Connor. Craig, who is a music journalist, had interviewed her once on the phone. We'll come back and talk to you a little bit about that. And what do you think? We should just press play on these calls, right?
Yeah, let's hear them.
First up, we're going to hear from Mark Neese.
Hello, Rockin' the Suburbs, Jim and Patrick, and the entire Rockin' the Suburbs community. I am answering Jim's call, or Jim's request, for people to call in or send in voice messages about the recent passing of Sinead O'Connor. I was a little bit late to Sinead. I first heard her sometime, I'm guessing, 1988. I was at my college friend Tom's house off campus, and he had the CD of The Lion and the Cobra, which I think he'd borrowed from somebody, and he wanted me to make a dub cassette for him, because I don't think he had the capability of doing that. So that was the first time I heard her, and I think the very first song that I heard by Sinead was Mandinka. And I was immediately hooked. It was really, you know, really great rock song, kind of Rolling Stonesy guitar sound, very catchy. So that was my introduction to Sinead. And then, of course, there was just the way she looked. The shaved head. I mean, I don't think I'd ever seen a woman look like that before. It was very striking. I think it was striking for everybody. It was as if she was saying, take me seriously as an artist. I'm not a sex object. I am not an object of desire. I am not an object of the male gaze or of male desire. I am an artist, and I demand to be taken seriously as such. And I don't know that I completely understood that at the time, but the more that I think about it, the more that I think that that was the message that she was trying to convey. Her appearance and her presentation was so ahead of its time. I mean, this is before, you know, we didn't have the Riot Girl movement yet, so we didn't have people like Bikini Kill and Liz Phair and L7. You know, really, when you think of the mid to late 80s and you think of women in music, I mean, you're thinking of like Cyndi Lauper maybe, or Madonna. You know, we might have had Natalie Merchant had emerged at that point, but she was really more of kind of a gentler folk rock person at that point. So Sinead was very much ahead of her time, I think. So yeah, that first album, The Lion and the Cobra, that was really my introduction. And then just recently I've been listening to her second album, been listening to it in the car on the way to and from work. The second album, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. And I'm really struck by the stylistic range of that album, which I think I'd kind of forgotten because I hadn't listened to it in a while. So, I mean, obviously you've got the huge hit, Nothing Compares to You, which is beautiful and soulful and a tremendous vocal, emotional vocal performance by Sinead. But there's so much more on that album as well. I mean, you've got like a song like I'm Stretched on Your Grave, which combines traditional Irish folk music with that James Brown funky drummer drum loop. It's just quite an incredible marriage of two different musical styles that still works brilliantly. And then, you know, a song like The Emperor's New Clothes that combines confessional lyrics about trouble in a relationship and a pregnancy with a really catchy pop rock musical feel.
Yeah.
you know, that wonderful marriage of deep and profound lyrics with very catchy music. And, you know, don't we all love that? I think everybody in the community really appreciates that. And then there's like a song like Black Boys on Mopeds discusses, you know, violence against people of color. I mean, I think for me as a, you know, a white kid growing up in a small town, lyrics like that were pretty profound and real eye-openers. Now, moving on, I've been thinking recently, and now that Sinead has died, it feels like there's praise that's sort of coming out of the woodwork, and I think we forget how badly she was mistreated after her appearance on Saturday Night Live and the tearing of the Pope picture, which, I mean, looking back on it, I think I was just a bit puzzled by it. I had no idea the child sexual abuse that was going on in the church. And then, you know, about a week later, she was on the Bob Dylan 30th anniversary tribute concert and received a terrible reception and was booed. And I do remember thinking the irony of that. You know, here's a concert that is in honor of Bob Dylan, someone who spoke his mind in the 60s and was considered part of the counterculture, which really, you know, Sinead O'Connor was sort of following in his footsteps, and yet she's at this concert being booed by these alleged Bob Dylan fans for speaking her mind. And I just remember at the time thinking that was really unfortunate and very ironic coming from Bob Dylan fans. But I don't think that I feel like I didn't do enough to stick up for her, because at the same time, you know, she'd become the butt of jokes and the butt of parodies, people making fun of her on comedy shows, and I'm sure I was one of those people laughing at those jokes, and I don't feel proud of it. And I feel that I could have done more. I feel like maybe I could have done more to stick up for her. I don't know exactly what. You know, what if I'd written her a letter or something and offered my support. So anyway, I will stop babbling and hope that everybody in the community is doing well and keep rocking the suburbs. Take care.
All right, we thank Mark Neese for those thoughtful comments.
Very much.
Any thoughts from you all on what Mark had to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was, you know, right on with he said at the end about her look and everything. And that's something that came up when I did that phoner with her. That was in 2014 when I guess it was her last album. I know she was working on one that was almost completed at the time of her death, but it was an album called I'm Not Bossy, I'm the Boss. And on the cover, Sinead wore a wig and a really tight-fitting dress. And, you know, I think she was trying to get attention and trying to sort of flip the script a little bit. But at that time, she was in a war of words with Miley Cyrus because she was quite distressed by Miley's Wrecking Ball video and the fact that she was, you know, naked and licking a sledgehammer and all that sort of thing. So they were kind of going, well, it was mostly a one-sided war of words because Sinead was attacking Miley and Miley took the high road and said that she liked her and, you know, that she thinks she's a great artist and everything. But Sinead, when I talked to her, they had one video done for one of the tracks that actually came out. Oh, Take Me to Church. And that she also wore the wig and a tight dress, but they also had, it's kind of interesting video. I just looked at it recently that they had footage. I think it was from Nothing Compares to You. And that was sort of projected over her look with the wig, her glam look. So it's, you know, quite a contrast. But at the time when we did this interview, she said that she wanted to do another video for another track on the album in which she would dress up in a, like, sort of a granny fat suit and sort of recreate the wrecking ball video. As an old lady with sagging skin. And she seemed to be serious about that. I don't think it ever happened. I have a feeling what probably happened is that the album didn't really like catch fire. She was on network at the time and they probably like pulled her funding. So it probably never was made. That's what I'm assuming, but interesting nonetheless. You know, Mark said, you know, about the whole Pope episode is, yeah. You know, like it or not, you know, she had a point of view often and she wasn't afraid to express it. I know I wanted to get her for my number one albums book, but one thing I went back and read it, one thing that I reminded myself of, not only even before the Pope ripping up the Pope's picture on SNL, she refused to go on SNL, mm-hmm. few weeks before, because Andrew Dice Clay was going to be the guest host.
Right.
So, you know, she spoke out. She wasn't afraid to, speak her mind and, you know, whatever the ramifications on her career, so be it. You know, she wasn't going to be muzzled and wasn't going to be quiet.
Yeah, totally. I think this was absolutely somebody who, walked the walk, right?
Mm-hmm.
She spoke her mind, she had her beliefs, and she was strident in that. And I think that she should be very much respected for that. The thing that I thought was interesting was when she reflected back on that incident, tearing up the photo of the Pope on television, she claimed that that sort of, you know, righted her career for her in her mind, you know, whereas to everybody else, it, you know, was career suicide.
Mm-hmm.
She felt like it got her back on track to being the artist she wanted to be and not be so beholden anymore to, you know, the music industry. Craig, I want to ask you one other thing on that interview, though. I mean, I know it was a phone interview, but you know, what was it like talking with her? Like, you know, we're just talking about somebody who could be so, I think, intense. I guess might be the way you would describe her. What was her demeanor like, just in sort of having a conversation?
I think she was friendly, and I think we probably had a few chuckles together when she was talking about her plans for that video. I remember it as a pleasant experience, and you know, sometimes you hang up the phone or whatever, and you're like, oh, that was odd, but I didn't get that feeling. Unfortunately, I looked for the audio file. I haven't located it yet. You know, it's like, I used to take notes by typing while I was speaking to the person. So an old early habit to turn things around quickly. So that way I could, you know, find the part in the recording that I wanted to use.
Right.
I did locate that, but it's not real easy to read. and interestingly, at the bottom of my the thing that was published on Yahoo, then Yahoo Music, but it's still up there. It says that there's going to be a second one when the album comes out. I couldn't locate that at all. I don't know if I did it. I think I did, because Lindsay Parker, also who I worked with at Yahoo, referred to something from the interview about her relationship to Prince. I remember her asking her about that, but that wasn't in the piece that I wrote about the initial piece I wrote. So who knows? But I just remember her being pleasant, and, you know, I was honored and, you know, excited to speak to her. And it was a pleasant experience.
Good. Yeah. Okay. All right. Nice. As I mentioned, we have another listener with some thoughts. This is Jason Goble.
Hey, Jim, Pat, Jason Goble checking in. I wanted to leave a message on Sinead O'Connor and her recent passing. I was a fan of the first two albums, and I also loved Am I Not Your Girl, which is the album that she did with the big band. But in the 90s, I was really a creature of radio and MTV, so when she faded from the spotlight, I completely lost track of her. I mean, I did see her in 2005. She was part of a show I went to where she did songs from a reggae album I think she was either releasing or had just released. But that was really just a mere curiosity and didn't really re-spark my interest. What did re-spark my interest this year was I watched at the beginning of the year a documentary that was released last year. It's the documentary is Nothing Compares. It's available and still available, I guess, on Showtime On Demand. And I would recommend it if you ever had an interest in her, or if you're now curious in light of her recent passing. I was a big fan of this documentary. She has been one of my more listened to artists this entire year, even before she passed. And since she passed, she's been on repeat the last couple of days. The documentary made clear that she never really wanted to be famous. She just wanted to record her music. One of the great stories in the documentary is about the making of her great debut album, The Lion and the Cobra. And, the documentary talked about how her record label just wanted her to be this cookie cutter vanilla singer, and she finally reacted to what she was, what she was initially doing that's when she shaved her head and, basically scrapped the initial recording of the album and re-recorded it to, the brilliant debut that ultimately was released. Even with her seminal album, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, she turned it into a record label who didn't want to release it. And she basically said, take it or leave it, which thankfully they took it. Her music was, always sort of distinct, from that first album. One of my favorite songs is the song Jerusalem, which sounded at the time and still even today sounds like fresh, original, and only something she could do.
Thank you.
Her voice, one of the best voices ever in music. Listen to the title track of I Don't Want What I Haven't Got, where it's just her a cappella and the voice is haunting yet beautiful at the same time. She was actually a great duet partner. I'd recommend two things from Willie Nelson's Across the Borderline album. She joins Willie Nelson on Don't Give Up and does a great job on the Kate Bush part. And one of my favorite YouTube go-to clips is her appearance she did on Letterman with Van Morrison and the Chieftains of them doing Have I Told You Lately, where Sinead O'Connor essentially holds down the song while Van Morrison is doing his scatting and the beautiful playing of the Chieftains behind it. Unfortunately, I didn't come to this album until this year, but was thankfully discovered her last release. I'm Not Bossy, I'm the Boss. I'll just say worth a listen if you, again, have any interest in her. Because I think it's a very, very good album. It's folk, it's rock, it's bluesy, it's still her in great voice. I think the songs are great. One of the songs that has became a favorite of mine when I first listened to the album early in the year is song Eight Good Reasons. It's a song where she's reflecting on her music career, and it includes the line, you know, I love to make music, but my head got wrecked by the business. But, you know, notwithstanding, you know, again, I think the documentary shows, and even that song makes clear, she, you know, loved what she did, and she was not apologetic about anything she ever did. To me, you gotta respect that. So, rest in power, Sinead O'Connor, and I hope you're at peace.
All right. Thank you to Jason Goble for that message.
Yeah, very much. I would like to pick up really quickly on two things Jason said. One, I wasn't the biggest Sinead O'Connor fan. And one thing, you know, I was reading some of these tributes and some of these obituaries about her, there was a couple times mentioned that she didn't want the public image things that happened, you know, whether it be her stance or being booed off stage or whatever that might be. She didn't want that to take away from people getting to her music. That's what happened to me, unfortunately. It was those events that, and for whatever reason, you know, it's hard to go back and know where your mind was at a certain time when these things happened, but that kept me away, I think, from exploring, you know, the music in a more deep form, which is too bad. And yeah. Over this past week, I've been going back and people have been giving me suggestions and things like that. And I totally agree what Jason said about the way she used spareness to create power, whether it was just her voice and an acoustic guitar, or she used these dramatic pauses or dropouts in some of her music. But somebody pointed me toward the reggae album that Jason mentioned. It's called Throw Down Your Arms. It was a record that came out in 2005, and it's completely consisting of covers. I believe there's about, I don't know, six or seven Burning Spear covers on this of the 15 or so songs, and I love Burning Spear. And I just thought, there's no way that she could possibly pull this off, and without a doubt, she totally does it.
My Marcus Garvey words come to pass. Marcus Garvey words come to pass. Ain't got no food to eat. Ain't got no money to spend. Oh, ain't got no food to eat. Ain't got no money to spend.
It's pretty amazing. Sly and Robbie play on this record, along with a couple other people. It was recorded at Tuff Gong in Kingston, Jamaica. I would encourage people to go and listen to it, and it's going to blow you away, because it blew me away. I was just like, there's no way that she could possibly get this done, and actually she does it. So pretty incredible. But yeah, those, thank you, Jason, for those thoughts. But that's what sprang to my mind when I was listening to him, was I had just listened to that album yesterday, and I just thought, wow, this can't be her. I mean, it's really incredible how she embodies that spirit of of rebellion and longing and all those things and that happened in a lot of these songs. It's amazing.
Yeah, I got to check that record out. That's one that I don't have, the reggae record. But yeah, you know, like you were saying, the one thing, she was like incredibly musically diverse. I mean, it was was it Mark or Jason that mentioned the sort of jazz standards record she did? Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. One of her hits was, you know, Lay Your Hands on Me, which, you know, like had a hip hop beat. And I think MC Light collaborated with her on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, aside from like the fans loving her, I think other musicians really loved her. She did like a lot of collaborations and like even I think like one of her first released recordings even before her debut album was on a compilation record that The Edge played on. And then on her first album, Marco Peroni and Kevin Mooney from Adam and the Ants were in her band. And later, which is weird, I saw a clip on the news the other day, and I'm like, oh, look, that's Andy Rourke playing bass with her. You know,
amazing.
The Smiths rhythm section played on, I think, maybe the second album, or they played with her early on. And, you know, like Jason mentioned, Willie Nelson and, you know, Chris Christopherson came to her defense at that concert. And, you know, of course, all roads lead to REM. Michael Stipe covered the last day of our acquaintance. He did that live at VH1 Honors in 96. And he posted a tribute. And I don't know if you guys saw that. And there was also the big Morrissey screed, which may have been more about Morrissey than Sinead. But I'm sure there's some truth to it. You know, he was talking about how, you know, all the record executives and journalists are singing her praises now, but when she was desperate and, you know, people kind of forgot about her and ignored her, you know, and that, you know, unfortunately, you know, sort of pop music or the music business is kind of brutal. Even fans, you know, we either stick to the old favorites or want to hear the next new thing. And we kind of forget about these artists that have been toiling away, the veteran artists that maybe aren't grabbing the headlines anymore. We start to take them for granted, and it is kind of sad, you know. It happens. I mean, it happened like with Prince, it happened with Elvis Costello, happens with like X or whatever. It's like then you sort of rediscover these people, but you know, they put out too many records too quickly, and too much to digest, and it's, you know, it, a lot of it doesn't measure up to the earlier work, and, you know, sometimes people just forget about the artist.
It's a great point, Craig, and just looking on paper at her discography, it did not follow any discernible pattern. The records didn't come out consistently. They weren't always like the same sound. You know, she was experimenting, doing duets, like you said, all over the place. So that, in its sense, made it very difficult for sort of the mainstream music consumer to follow, you know, here's the next song that sounded like the last one, or here's the next Prince cover or whatever.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a good point. And that reminds me of something, somebody that I talked to fairly recently was Paul Simonon of The Clash. And he's got this new thing with Galen Ayers, who is Kevin Ayers' daughter. And I mentioned that to him, that his work has been so sporadic. And he said, well, you know, we're artists. I mean, we're not on the treadmill. We do when you know, the muse hits us, when inspiration hits us, that's when we'll make a record. And I think that's what Sinead probably was like. She didn't want to be on the industry treadmill and feel like she owed, you know, the record company an album every year or 2 years. She did it on her own timetable when she was inspired. And I mean, and I think that's probably why her catalog is so strong and so diverse. You know, back to this thing of not really appreciating artists, I'm guilty as charged. You know, unfortunately, a lot of times I have, you know, this room full of CDs and a closet full of vinyl. And a lot of times I only, you know, pull these records out after somebody has died, unfortunately.
Yeah,
right.
Great point.
Yeah, and
that's right.
And I was sort of surprised. I didn't realize I had 6 Sinead O'Connor CDs, and I put them on, and you know, I was working, and I listened to them all while I was working, and you know, they were all like strong quality. You know, they weren't given my full attention, but a few things jumped out at me. You know, her cover of "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina." She also did a cover of All Apologies, the Nirvana song.
All apologies. What else should I say? Everyone is gay. What else could I write? I don't have.
Is really chilling. I mean, you know, it's like you think about, you know, some of her, you know, of course, her best known song, like, you know, Kurt's dead, Prince is dead, and now Sinead's dead.
I just want to quickly say one thing here. I want to touch on something that I think Mark said about when Sinead O'Connor debuted. So the album The Lion and the Cobra was her debut album, and it came out in the late 80s, and it was the one before, you know, the big breakthrough hit. Mm-hmm. But I remember, because I was in college at the time, I remember The Lion and the Cobra being a big deal. Like, like people really got into that album. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's a very strong record. But I think part of it, too, you got to give her credit for being a pioneer of sorts. As Mark said, that was an era. There were not a lot of women in, you know, alternative rock.
Mm-hmm.
There just weren't. It wasn't like today. You know, landscape is totally different now than it was back then. And, you know, I compare maybe to like a Patti Smith or somebody like that, in terms of the type of artist she was, but they were few and far between at that time, and for her to I think succeed in that environment, in that industry the way it was then, I think we have to give her some real credit for as well.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely. I mean, there was, you know, there were like the you know, a little before that, there were like, you know, the Go-Go's, the Bangles, and Joan
right.
Jett. But
right.
they all, you know, they all, even Joan, you know, had, you know, sort of, you know, they were strong female, long hair, somewhat glamorous. I mean, Joan was a little harder, but, you know, Sinead really like right. flipped a script, and she wasn't afraid to do that, you know, so... one other song that really, you know, jumped out at me that I don't know if I remembered previously, this song called Famine, which is sort of like a spoken word interpolation of Eleanor Rigby. And it's about,
oh, really?
And it's about the Irish famine. And she's a denier. She said there wasn't any Irish famine. It was, you know, they were keeping, you know, food from Ireland. England was keeping, you know, the good food, the state, the meat and everything else from Ireland. And, you know, that's why, you know, the Irish people were existing on potatoes. It's kind of, you know, I don't know how historically accurate that is. But again, that's Sinead taking her stance and not afraid to speak her mind. Right. And since it does, you know, have that Eleanor Rigby part in it, you know, I guess McCartney signed off on it. And
must have.
Of course, he recorded Give Ireland Back to the Irish. So I guess they were on the same page.
I was listening to that song yesterday, Craig, Famine. It's a really good song.
Yeah.
Good call out there. Okay, we need to wrap things up. So thanks very much, Craig, for joining us. Rest in power, Sinead O'Connor.
Yes, rest in power.
It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you all later.
Okay, I want to talk about Ireland. Specifically, I want to talk about the famine, about the fact that there never really was one. There was no famine. See, Irish people were only allowed to eat potatoes. All of the other food, meat, fish, vegetables, was shipped out of the country under armed guard to England while the Irish people starved. And then, in the middle of all this, they gave us money not to teach our children Irish. And so we lost our history, and this is what I think is still hurting me. You see, we're like a child that, being battered, has to drive itself out of its head because it's frightened, still feels all the painful feelings. But they lose contact with the memory, and this leads to massive self-destruction, alcoholism, drug addiction, all desperate attempts at running. And in its worst form, becomes actual killing. And if there ever is gonna be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving, so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding. All the lonely people, where do they all come from? An American army regulation says you mustn't kill more than 10% of a nation, because to do so causes permanent psychological damage. It's not permanent, but they didn't know that. Anyway, during the supposed famine, we lost a lot more than 10% of our nation through deaths on land or in ships of emigration. But what finally broke us was not starvation, but its use in the controlling of our education. Schools go on about Black 47, on and on about the terrible famine. But what they don't say is, in truth, there really never was one.
Excuse me.
The lonely people.
I'm sorry, excuse me.
Where do they all come from?
I can tell you in one word.
Oh, the lonely people. Where do they all belong?
So let's take a look, shall we? The highest statistics of child abuse in the East.
You have to remember in yourself that you're not what people think of you.